Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're really going deep into crisis management, but with a bit of a twist.
A twist?
Well, you'll see. It's all about how vital it is to factor in culture when we're facing these increasingly complex disasters that seem to be happening more and more.
That's right. We need to go beyond the typical crisis response frameworks and look deeper at those cultural dynamics that are always at play, but often hidden.
And the guide for this exploration is the Crisis Subcultures Report, released just this past January by Scenario DNA.
This report really nails it when it says that a community's experience of a crisis and how they navigate it is deeply shaped by its values and its history and its practices.
Okay, so let's unpack that. The report starts by making this distinction between uncertainty and ambiguity.
Yeah, that's key. Uncertainty is when we know the variables are there, but can't predict the exact outcome.
So like with a hurricane, we know it's coming.
Right. We know it's coming. But the precise impact on each community, well, that's still uncertain.
Ambiguity, though, that's when you don't even know what the variables are.
Exactly. Think back to the early days of COVID. Conflicting information, the situation changing rapidly. It was ambiguity we were dealing with because we didn't even know all the factors at play.
So in crisis management, how does that difference actually matter?
Well, with uncertainty, you can try to predict, but with ambiguity, you have to keep reinterpreting. It's not just about forecasting. It's constantly adapting your understanding as new information comes to light.
And the report says that ambiguity, that's becoming the defining characteristic of modern crises, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, think about how interconnected everything is. Climate change, the economy, social unrest. These issues are so intertwined, they create these complex cascading effects that you just can't explain with simple cause and effect.
The report uses the California wildfires as a perfect example of that. Displacement, housing crises, public health risks, all these consequences stemming from an environmental disaster.
And then they all impact each other. You can't look at any of them in isolation.
Which means those single-cause solution approaches to managing crises just won't work anymore.
Right. And that's where the report suggests that our traditional foresight methods are falling short.
So those tools like scenario planning and stakeholder analysis, those are still useful.
Of course. But they often miss those crucial cultural and grassroots elements.
Like what happened in Fukushima.
Yeah.
Even with all the stakeholder analysis and the aid coordination, cultural attitudes towards authority really impacted the effectiveness of the response.
Exactly. And Hurricane Harvey, too. FEMA relying so much on predictive analytics, which is great in theory, but it wasn't aligned with grassroots networks, which are often the real first responders on the ground.
Those are such powerful examples. So how do we start to bridge this gap? The report talks about culture mapping. What is that exactly?
Culture mapping is a way to categorize subcultures based on how they act and their roles during crises.
And it provides a much more comprehensive view compared to those traditional methods we were talking about. And the report breaks it down into four main categories: dominant, residual, emergent, and disruptive. Let's start with the dominant subcultures. How would you define those?
Think of the established structures in a community. Dominant subcultures, they focus on stability and mobilizing resources.
So things like community advocacy groups or religious organizations.
Exactly. They're often the ones with the resources, the networks, and they can mobilize a response very quickly. Their goal is always to restore things to normal, get those essential services up and running again.
Got it. Then there are the residual subcultures. What sets them apart?
Residual subcultures, they're all about tradition and continuity.
So they're the ones who often hold that knowledge that's been passed down for generations.
Exactly. The report uses a great example, Indigenous fire management practitioners in Australia.
And their expertise in controlled burns was initially overlooked, but it actually offered sustainable, resilient solutions, things that we've kind of forgotten.
And that's the value of residual subcultures. That connection to the past can be crucial in figuring out how to handle today's challenges. They offer those practical solutions, time-tested, and those can be integrated with our modern approaches.
Okay, so then there are the emergent subcultures.
These are the innovators, always adapting. Think of digital volunteers or tech-savvy groups. They use technology to fill those gaps in crisis response that traditional institutions can't always get to.
Like how digital volunteers provided all those real-time updates during the Beirut explosion and even helped allocate resources.
Yes. Emergent subcultures, they're agile. They think outside the box, utilize those new technologies, always looking for a new way to solve a problem.
And finally, the disruptive subcultures.
These are the ones who challenge the status quo. They see a crisis and they see a chance to address those underlying inequities.
So they're the ones who often bring those overlooked issues to light.
Exactly. Like climate justice advocates during the California wildfires, they pushed institutions to consider the disproportionate impact of those fires on marginalized communities.
So they're the critical voice holding those in power accountable and making sure the response is equitable, not just effective.
Precisely. Disruptive subcultures, they force us to confront those uncomfortable truths. Their role is really essential to make sure that our crisis responses are just, not just effective.
It's a really thought-provoking approach, this culture mapping. But how does it work practically?
Well, the report proposes combining culture mapping with generative AI to create simulations.
Simulations?
Yeah, to see how these subcultures might actually interact and how they might influence each other during a crisis.
Wow, that's innovative. But how can AI really model these complex cultural interactions?
Generative AI, it can synthesize huge amounts of data and model those complex scenarios. So in this case, it can analyze cultural patterns, behaviors, even historical data to simulate how different subcultures might respond.
So it's like a virtual sandbox to see how those groups might interact and respond in a given crisis.
Exactly. It allows us to test strategies, anticipate challenges, get a much more nuanced understanding of the cultural dynamics.
And the report gives that example of indigenous fire management practices, showing how AI can highlight how beneficial it is to integrate traditional knowledge.
Yes. By simulating those interactions, we can uncover those hidden narratives and biases that we might not see otherwise.
But simulating human behavior, especially during a crisis, that has to come with ethical considerations. How does the report address that?
It really emphasizes incorporating something called anticipatory governance.
What's it?
It's about being proactive, taking early action, engaging stakeholders, making sure decisions are equitable and responsive to the situation.
So it's not just predicting the future, it's shaping it in a responsible and inclusive way.
Exactly.
Well, now that we've got a sense of the broader concepts, let's look at each of these subcultures individually and see how they play out in those specific crisis scenarios that are outlined in the report.
Let's start with residual subcultures. Their deep connection to tradition and heritage often means they have those sustainable and resilient solutions that are often overlooked by modern systems.
Like the example the report gives, the Australian bushfires in 2019 and 2020.
Right. The focus then was all on the institutional firefighting agencies and NGOs. But the indigenous communities, they had those traditional fire management practices, the controlled burns.
Which actually are proven to be effective in reducing how severe those wildfires get.
But those practices, they were sidelined. And that's often the disconnect between those institutional systems and those residual subcultures.
The report suggests that if those traditional practices had been integrated, the ecological and societal costs of those bushfires, they could have been significantly reduced.
It's a powerful reminder that residual subcultures, they have so much knowledge and experience to offer.
Knowledge that's often untapped.
And it's a vital link to the past. They give us those insights we need to navigate the challenges we're facing today and do it in a way that's sustainable and resilient.
Okay, let's talk about dominant subcultures. We mentioned before, they're often the key players in stabilizing communities and mobilizing resources in a crisis.
These groups, with their strong community ties, they're often the first responders. They step up to fill those gaps because institutional systems, they can be slow.
The report uses the example of Hurricane Katrina in 2005.
Yes. Grassroots organizers in New Orleans, they provided those essential services, housing, food, healthcare, because institutional stakeholders were completely overwhelmed.
But the report also points out that they were left out of the centralized planning, which caused a lot of strain and probably made recovery harder.
Exactly. That's the challenge, isn't it? We need to find a way to effectively integrate dominant subcultures into our formal crisis management plans.
Because their local knowledge, their networks, and their understanding of what the community needs, those are invaluable.
The report talks about developing something called trust-based crisis collaboration platforms, where institutions and these grassroots groups can work together, align resources, and make decisions together.
Build trust.
Right. That way, we can get a much more coordinated and effective response.
Moving on to emergent subcultures. We've talked about how innovative and adaptable they are.
Right. These are our tech-savvy individuals, decentralized online communities. They fill the gaps that traditional institutions just can't.
And the report talks about how those digital volunteers were so vital during the Beirut explosion.
Yes, they were the ones coordinating those real-time updates, allocating resources, filling those gaps in communication because it was such a chaotic situation.
But that decentralized nature, that can also be a challenge. It can lead to miscommunication or duplicated efforts, especially when they're trying to work with government agencies.
That's where we need systems that can bring that agility of the emergent subcultures together with the structure and the resources that institutions have.
The report talks about establishing decentralized crisis innovation hubs.
Exactly. A platform to connect those emergent subcultures with institutions, foster collaboration, make sure those tech-driven solutions are actually integrated into crisis response strategies.
So it's a space where innovation can happen.
Yeah.
But still in a coordinated way. And finally, let's look at disruptive subcultures, the ones who challenge the system.
These are the groups driven by justice. They hold power structures accountable, and they make sure that crisis responses are equitable and just.
The report gives the example of climate justice advocates during the California wildfires.
They pointed out that resources weren't being distributed equally and that the fires were impacting marginalized communities much more severely. Their advocacy, it led to policy changes. But the report also says that the conflicts they had with government agencies, it slowed down the implementation of those reforms.
It shows that tension that often exists between these disruptive subcultures and the established institutions.
It's true, they can create friction, but they're also vital. They challenge assumptions, push for those systemic changes, and that's what creates a more just and equitable society.
So what's the solution there?
The report recommends developing what they call accountability and reform toolkits. So institutions have a structured way to engage with these groups, learn from them, and address the systemic issues they bring to light.
Channel their energy?
Yes. Turn it into constructive change. The report actually goes beyond just outlining these subcultures. It puts them into action using these simulated crisis scenarios.
Oh, wow. So we can see them in action.
Yes. Yeah. They're incredibly detailed. It gives us a look at how the subcultures interact and how they could influence the outcome.
So it's one thing to define the group, but to actually see how they operate in a crisis.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
The first one focuses on an epidemic outbreak.
Where?
In a coastal region. Highly contagious virus spreading rapidly, densely populated, healthcare systems overwhelmed.
Sounds chaotic. How do those different subcultures respond?
It highlights how residual subcultures, they might resist those institutional public health campaigns at first.
Because they just don't trust them.
It could be that. Imagine community health advocates or traditional healers. They might not trust the centralized vaccine distribution, or they might advocate for alternative approaches based on their knowledge.
So that clash between the institutions and what the residual subcultures believe could actually hinder the response.
Right. That's why the report says it's crucial to acknowledge and address these cultural dynamics. Well, it has this integrated cultural foresight toolkit with different methods of analysis.
Okay.
One of them is called red team analysis. And that's where you identify vulnerabilities in your communication strategies. That's essential, especially when there might already be that low trust in institutions.
Mm-hmm. What about the other subcultures? How do they factor into this?
Well, the simulation also shows how dominant subcultures can step in.
How so?
Think of community leaders or faith-based organizations. They can mobilize those local resources and provide support.
Because they already have those connections and they understand the community.
Exactly.
So agencies should work with them.
That's one of the recommendations, yes. Public health agencies should collaborate with those community leaders, co-create vaccine awareness campaigns that are tailored for that community, build trust. The simulations actually validate this approach. They show that inclusive messaging, it enhances vaccine adoption, and that improves public health outcomes.
It's fascinating to see that those simulations can help us to see those challenges ahead of time and then identify what strategies will actually be effective.
Exactly.
What's another scenario?
The next one? It's an urban infrastructure collapse.
What happened?
Imagine an earthquake hits a major city, cripples those essential services. Transportation, power, communication.
Devastating. What cultural dynamics come into play there?
This simulation, it looks at the rebuilding efforts and the potential tension. You could have advocates for a pedestrian-friendly design, butting heads with those who want to prioritize cars.
So even in a crisis, those underlying values about what the city should be, they come out.
Exactly. And that can cause conflicts, delays. So the report's toolkit suggests combining culture mapping with something called alternate futures analysis.
What does that do?
It helps explore if different approaches could work. Like, in this case, could you have elements of both? Pedestrian zones and car access.
Find balance.
Right. And the simulations using that toolkit show that a hybrid approach can actually lead to a more equitable and sustainable recovery.
So those simulations aren't just about predicting what will happen. It's about seeing what could be.
Exactly. We can test out those different approaches, see which ones lead to the outcomes we want.
I like that. Okay, what else does the report look at?
The next simulation is a national food safety outbreak. So a contaminated food product distributed all over the country. Lots of people getting sick, panic.
Sounds scary.
This scenario explores the tension between food justice advocates.
Who want accountability.
Yes, and transparency. Butting heads with those big food corporations who want to protect their profits and reputation.
It's that classic clash of values and priorities. How does that play out?
Well, the simulation uses that red team analysis to see how vulnerable those food safety systems really are, and also to gauge how skeptical the public is. But then it uses alternate futures analysis to look at different frameworks for managing the crisis.
Like, what kinds of frameworks are they testing?
One scenario is that the food corporation is proactive. So they commit resources to figuring out where that contamination came from, communicate openly with the public, work with experts to contain the outbreak.
So it's self-serving, but it also acknowledges the need to be accountable.
Right. But it goes further than that. They don't just manage the immediate problem. They create a whole new food safety framework with stakeholders, advocacy groups, scientists, independent auditors.
Collaborative. So they're trying to build trust for the future.
Exactly. And the simulations, they show that this approach is actually effective.
So a crisis, as disruptive as it is, can also lead to positive change.
Absolutely. Businesses don't have to just manage the crisis. They can use it as a catalyst to build a system that's more resilient and responsible.
I like that. What about a natural disaster? Does the report cover that?
Yes. One of the simulations is a powerful tornado that hits a close-knit farming community, and this one shows the immediate response of those dominant subcultures.
So religious organizations.
Yes, and neighborhood groups. They mobilize, provide shelter, food, emotional support. They're deeply rooted in the community, so they can act quickly.
It's a good reminder that in those early stages of a crisis, those community members are often the real first responders.
Yes. But the simulation also explores some tension between those grassroots efforts and the formal disaster relief agencies.
Because?
Well, those federal and state responders, they'll have resources and expertise, but they might focus more on infrastructure rather than the immediate needs of that community.
Different priorities. So how do you navigate that?
The simulation says to use culture mapping, identify what those religious networks and neighborhood groups do well, and then use red team analysis to find those inefficiencies and how resources are being distributed.
Okay.
They came up with this idea for a shared resource allocation framework, co-created by the institutional responders and the grassroots organizations.
So they're working together,
yeah.
Leveraging everyone's strengths.
And the simulations using that toolkit show that it works. It improves efficiency, reduces duplication of effort, and builds public trust.
That's a great example. Okay, so the report has covered a pandemic, an earthquake, and a tornado. What else?
One simulation focuses on a cyber attack.
On what?
Critical infrastructure in a big city. Imagine the power grid going down. Transportation, healthcare, communications, everything disrupted.
It would bring the city to a standstill? How do emergent subcultures respond to that?
This one is all about the crisis mappers and those digital volunteers, the ones who use open source platforms and real-time data collection.
So they're providing that on-the-ground information.
Yeah.
About the damage and what people need.
Exactly. But there are challenges. Government agencies, they're not always comfortable using data from those decentralized groups because it's often unregulated.
So how do you balance the agility of those emergent groups with the need for security and control?
The simulation says to use culture mapping. Identify those emergent groups because they're the innovators. Then use red team analysis. That's where you find that potential mistrust between them and the institutions. And it leads to the idea of a secure data sharing framework.
So they can still use that expertise, but in a secure way.
Right. It's co-created by the responders and those external technologists. And the simulations that use this framework, they show that it increases transparency, improves coordination, and gets things back to normal much faster.
Okay, so the cyber attack is covered. What about, like, A flood.
Yes. There's a simulation of a devastating flood overwhelming a rural region. This one focuses on the emergent subcultures, the preppers networks, and those local resilience forums. These groups are all about self-sufficiency and preparedness.
So they're ready. They mobilize
yep.
quickly,
yep.
provide aid and support.
Yes. Often they don't even wait for the institutions.
But that could also cause problems.
Right. Exactly. That's what the simulation looks at. That tension between those grassroots efforts and the official crisis management task force.
Because the task force has a plan.
Yes. And those emergent groups, they might seem unregulated, even disruptive to the official plan.
So what does the simulation suggest?
Culture mapping to identify those unique values and strengths of both sides. Then use red team analysis to pinpoint where the priorities are misaligned or where they might be competing for resources. And it leads to this idea of a decentralized resource sharing platform.
So they're not working in silos. They're using a shared platform to coordinate.
Yes. Real-time communication, coordinated resource allocation, a much more streamlined and efficient response.
And the simulations back that up.
Yes. They show that it reduces redundancies, minimizes delays, and fosters trust between the stakeholders.
Flexibility and adaptability are key in a crisis.
Yeah.
That's a great example. Okay, so now we've covered floods too. What else does the report look at?
One simulation focuses on the media and public perception. Imagine a hurricane has just hit a coastal city, and the media is there, crews, social media influencers, and of course, relief agencies are trying to get in. And the simulation explores how this raises questions about disaster tourism.
Oh, yeah, that's a tough one. You need the media to raise awareness, but it can also be exploitative.
Exactly. And so this simulation introduces a new subculture, a disruptive one called ethical disaster tourism critics. And they demand accountability. They don't want the coverage to exploit those affected communities.
So they're the watchdogs.
Yes. The simulation uses culture mapping to identify the tension between the communities, the media, and the institutions. And then red team analysis highlights those risks if media relations are mishandled.
Okay.
So that leads to the idea of storytelling guidelines, prioritizing accuracy, dignity, and respect.
So you're still raising awareness. But you're doing it ethically.
Right. The simulation actually is the relief agencies partnering with those ethical disaster tourism critics and grassroots networks to develop the guidelines.
A collaborative approach.
And the simulations show it works. Ethical storytelling builds trust and strengthens those relationships between the stakeholders.
It's a great example of how those disruptive subcultures, they really can drive positive change just by asking the hard questions.
Exactly. They push us to be better.
Okay. Does the report have any more simulations?
One more. This one's about climate justice and wildfire recovery. So imagine there's been a huge wildfire. A government task force is in charge of the recovery, but they're being challenged by climate justice advocates.
Because
they're saying that recovery isn't just about rebuilding what was lost. It's about addressing those systemic issues, the things that made the impact of the wildfire worse for marginalized communities.
So it's about incorporating a wider range of perspectives
right.
to make sure the recovery is equitable and sustainable.
Exactly. And they want to see indigenous knowledge and practices being used in the recovery process. So the simulation uses culture mapping to identify those inequities, and then it uses red team analysis to see where there might be resistance to those non-traditional approaches.
Okay. And then what?
That leads to a scenario where the recovery task force co-creates a more inclusive policy. They work with climate justice advocates and grassroots leaders and representatives from those different subcultures.
So it becomes much more community-centered.
Yes. They prioritize equitable resource distribution, invest in community resilience, and integrate that indigenous knowledge into wildfire mitigation.
That's a holistic approach.
And the simulations show it leads to greater equity, resilience, and long-term sustainability.
It's a great example of how disruptive subcultures can really drive positive change. By challenging those assumptions and pushing for a more sustainable world, these simulations, they're fascinating.
They really give us a glimpse into how complex crisis response is and how important culture is.
And they show how valuable these new tools are, the culture mapping and the toolkit.
We need to move beyond those one-size-fits-all solutions, recognize that strategies need to be tailored for each cultural context.
The simulations really make the case for collaboration, communication,
mm-hmm.
and a willingness to learn from those different perspectives.
If we embrace those principles, we can build communities that are more resilient and better prepared to face the challenges that are ahead.
So we've seen all these simulations. How are these concepts being used in the real world?
Well, let's start with public health. The CDC is a great example. They've been dealing with vaccine hesitancy.
Which is a really complex issue. With those deep cultural roots, how have they been using cultural insights?
They're realizing that it's not just about the science. Vaccine acceptance, it's influenced by cultural beliefs and values and trust in those institutions. So they've started using culture mapping to identify the key subcultures and communities, figure out what their concerns are, and tailor those messages to resonate with their values.
So instead of one message for everyone, you address the specific concerns of each group.
Exactly. In some communities, traditional medicine is really important. So the CDC has partnered with local healers and community leaders. They're the ones sharing information about vaccines, addressing concerns from a culturally relevant perspective.
Because those are the people they trust, more than a generic announcement.
Right. It's about meeting people where they are, understanding their worldview, building trust. And it's working. Vaccine uptake has increased. And so has trust in public health.
It's a great example of how respecting cultural differences can make those interventions so much more effective. What about disaster preparedness and response? Are there any good examples there?
The International Red Cross and Red Crescent movement, they've been incorporating cultural considerations into their disaster relief efforts.
Disaster relief is usually seen as just logistics, providing food, shelter, medical care. How does culture fit into that?
They realize that it's not just about the material aid. You have to understand the cultural context, the coping mechanisms, how those communities traditionally respond to crises.
Because every culture has its own way.
Right. They've been using culture mapping to identify those subcultures in disaster-prone regions, analyze what makes them vulnerable and what their strengths are, and then they tailor their response.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. In some places, traditional housing is actually more resilient to certain types of disasters. So the Red Cross has adapted their shelter programs. They're using those local building techniques.
So they're not just handing out tents. They're working with the community, using what they already know. It's a much more sustainable approach.
And it shows respect for the community's expertise
and
their traditions. They've also been working with local leaders and traditional institutions because they play a vital role in disaster response.
So you're supporting those existing social structures.
Exactly. And that builds trust and strengthens community resilience. Disaster response, it's not just about logistics. It's about understanding and respecting the culture. What about the corporate world?
Yeah, I'm curious about that. Because culture is becoming so important for brand success and innovation.
Think about Google. They operate in so many countries with all those different cultures and languages.
So how do they create products that work for everyone?
They realized early on that a one-size-fits-all approach just won't work. They've put a lot of resources into creating products that are tailored to different cultures.
Like what?
Well, Google Translate. They've been working on it constantly. To account for the nuances of language.
Because language is tied to culture. It's not just words.
Right. They use machine learning and natural language processing to make the translations more accurate and fluent. But it goes beyond the technology. They've diversified their workforce. They know that having different perspectives in leadership and in the development process is crucial.
Those are the people behind it, too.
Yes. Having a diverse team allows them to understand a diverse audience, and it's made Google a leader in innovation. It shows that embracing diversity is a strength. What about marketing?
Yeah, that has to be a huge challenge, to create campaigns that resonate with different cultures.
Nike is a great example. They've always been good at understanding cultural trends, especially youth culture, and they use culture mapping to identify those key subcultures.
So they know their values and aspirations and what influences them.
Exactly. So they can create campaigns that connect with them on a deeper level. The language, the imagery, it's all aligned with their cultural identity.
Do you have an example?
Their recent campaign celebrating female athletes and body positivity, they've resonated really well with younger generations because they value inclusivity and empowerment.
It's tapping into that cultural shift.
Yes. Nike aligned their brand with those values. Mm-hmm. The campaigns felt authentic, empowering. And they've not only driven sales, they've strengthened Nike's image as a cultural leader. It's a powerful example of how connecting with those subcultures authentically can be a winning strategy.
So brands need to understand that cultural landscape.
Yes. Do the research. Listen. And represent diversity. That's how you cut through the noise. What about urban planning? How are they using cultural awareness? Medellin, Colombia, they've been using participatory design to incorporate the needs of diverse communities into their urban renewal projects.
Medellin has really transformed. It used to be known for violence and poverty, but now it's a model for urban design and social inclusion.
They realize that urban planning has to involve the residents. You have to understand what they need, what they want, and incorporate that into the design.
So it's a collaborative process.
Yes. They've used culture mapping to identify those subcultures in different neighborhoods, figure out their priorities, their challenges, and then use that information to develop public spaces, transportation, community facilities.
So it's not just about buildings, it's about what those residents need.
Exactly. They've created parks, libraries, community centers. They've improved transportation, so it's easier to get to those places.
Which is a huge factor in economic opportunity and social inclusion.
It's been really transformative, not just for the city itself, but for how the residents feel about their city. They feel a sense of ownership, pride. It shows that when you incorporate culture into urban planning, you can create communities that are more equitable, vibrant, and sustainable.
These are such great examples.
Yeah.
It's clear that culture mapping and the toolkit, they can be applied to so many sectors.
Yes. We're talking public health, disaster relief, technology, marketing, urban planning. They all benefit from understanding cultural dynamics, engaging those diverse stakeholders, and then actually incorporating those insights into their strategies.
Cultural awareness is not just a nice thing to have anymore. It's essential. But with any tool, there are potential pitfalls.
Yeah.
And ethical considerations.
Yeah, absolutely. We need to be mindful of those. Culture mapping and the toolkit, they give us valuable tools, but we need to be sensitive and aware of the potential challenges.
Well, we'll have to save that discussion for another deep dive. But for now, what are the key takeaways? What do you want listeners to remember?
Culture is not a side issue. It shapes everything, especially in a crisis. We need to go beyond those traditional crisis management models and embrace this cultural awareness.
And the report gives us a framework and tools to do that. It helps us anticipate those challenges and develop strategies that are more effective.
And it's not just for organizations, it's for all of us. We need to develop our cultural intelligence, be curious, be empathetic, be willing to learn.
In a world that's so interconnected, being able to bridge those cultural divides, that's how we'll thrive.
This has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you for joining us.